I left my heart in fire now, in the gold rush of the sun. Buenos Aires to Miami, I'm falling hard until I drown. I left my heart in Vienna, our glances by the candlelight. Love how he walks in his sombrero and plants a rose in every heart. I'm just here for the night, and I can't hold it tight. It took one look in your eyes to know I'm in paradise. You're like a star in my mind.
We'll be right back. the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
When we focus too much on narratives of pain and helplessness and victimhood, you have to look at the double-edged sword there. Yes, I'm aware that the Black Lives Matter movement and diversity and inclusion initiatives generally, they're focused on an awareness-based mission. Their mission is awareness, particularly white awareness of their own racism, with the idea that over time, this is going to gradually decrease societal bias and racism, right? That's the goal. But you have to, at the same time, when you're holding that in one hand, on the other hand, you have to look at the Black community. How are we involving the Black community? Are we thinking about them? How is this kind of mission and initiative and movement going to impact the Black community right now?
Kay Braden Anderson, attorney, entrepreneur, philanthropist, and author of Black Resilience, the Blueprint for Black Triumph in the Face of Racism, published by Post Hill Press. In 2020, Anderson made headlines for doing what very few law students have done. He earned his law degree while playing Division I basketball and managed to get the grades necessary to land a job at a top law firm. But Anderson's road to success didn't come easy. In 2013, he was involved in a serious car accident where he broke his neck. As a child growing up in Alberta, Canada, he recalled being called the N-word by a teacher, having no one to turn to, no recourse to how to deal with it. The son of a Nigerian father and an Irish mother, his family was the only mixed-race family in their Canadian community. In his book, Black Resilience, Anderson provides that powerful strategy for African-American success and empowerment in spite of biases. I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Black Resilience with Kay Braden Anderson, Esquire, In Black America.
My thinking was, if I could increase the awareness of my skill set and my profile as an athlete, I can get an opportunity to go to a better school next year, another boarding school with a real cafeteria, with a better education system, and I can really elevate my situation and my status. And that's what I did. So the next year I had an opportunity to go to Wilbraham and Munson, which is a school outside of Boston near Springfield, Mass. And it's an incredible institution, top level education that I received there, and ended up leveraging that to get a scholarship to Kansas, which was the number one overall basketball program in the country
right
at that time. And you got to zoom out and pause there for a second and think about what just happened to this kid who was homeless.
Being homeless is one of the many obstacles Kay Braden Anderson had to navigate. In his book, Black Resilience, he talked about overcoming childhood abuse, homelessness, and severe racism to become an attorney at the world's largest law firm and a successful entrepreneur. As a child growing up in Canada, Anderson experienced things you read about in books. In 2016, he won the Big East Conference Championship with the Seton Hall Pirates. In 2020, Anderson made headlines for becoming the first to ever play NCAA Division I men's basketball while attending law school full-time. 6 years in the making, Black Resilience is a book in which Anderson shares his personal experiences with racism and provides powerful strategies for African-American empowerment despite biases. According to Anderson, it's the evolution and progression of Black Lives Matter, carrying a voice that has been missing until now. Recent Black America spoke with attorney Anderson.
Yeah, I mean, so like Canada is a beautiful place and, you know, unfortunately for me, I think the circumstances that I was born into were challenging. Despite Canada being a pleasant place in general, I was born, you know, out of wedlock. My biological father played for Team Nigeria's basketball team, and that team played in the FIBA World Championships in 1991. And Team Nigeria, after the game, just defected almost the entire team. And, you know, their goal was, of course, to try to stay in the country however they could. And that did involve knocking up several women. And I became, you know, kind of a product of that. He wasn't really in my life. Met him for the first time when I was 14. But I think, you know, the unfortunate piece was, you know, the dynamic of growing up as a very extreme minority, right? In a town where we were the only black family, the only family with any color in it, right? And growing up without my real biological dad and having a stepdad who was abusive, it led to a very challenging situation for me where I dealt with a lot of racism. You know, I was tied to a tree by you know, members of, you know, the Aryan Brotherhood who, you know, identified as kind of KKK and, you know, had rocks thrown at me, you know, called all kinds of words. And also dealt with homelessness, right, to try to escape that abuse. And so I think my childhood in Canada was difficult, but at the end of the day, it ended up helping to temper, you know, the steel that became my mentality. And, you know, those challenges, oftentimes, if they don't kill you, they can make you stronger.
Yeah, no, that's right. As I alluded to prior to the conversation on air, what led you to write this book, The Black Resilience?
So it really was a culmination of all the experiences that I had had and how I was able to navigate through them and transcend above those obstacles. And I thought for years about how I could make a difference through what I was able to do. And I think with 2020 and George Floyd and Black Lives Matter and everything that was going on, I saw something that was deeply and sorely missing from the narrative, from the movement, missing from the diversity and inclusion initiatives. And it was the focus on Black resilience, on Black excellence, on Black empowerment, on focusing on variables that are within the Black community's control. When we focus too much on narratives of pain and helplessness and victimhood, you have to look at the double-edged sword there. Yes, I'm aware that the Black Lives Matter movement and diversity and inclusion initiatives generally, they're focused on an awareness-based mission. Their mission is awareness, particularly white awareness of their own racism, with the idea that over time, this is going to gradually decrease societal bias and racism, right? That's the goal. But you have to, at the same time, when you're holding that in one hand, on the other hand, you have to look at the Black community. How are we involving the Black community? Are we thinking about them? How is this kind of mission and initiative and movement going to impact the Black community right now, right? Not the societal increase of equality or decrease in bias 50 or 100 years from now, but how are we going to impact right now Black lives, and how are we figuring Black mental health into that conversation and combating learned helplessness, right? Because learned helplessness is caused by this idea that we continue to perpetuate through the Black Lives Matter movement and many others that white people are in control, right? It's this idea that we're all victims. We're waiting for white people to stop being racist so that we, the Black community, can start to find some success. And that narrative could not be more damaging to the Black spirit. It breaks people's hearts. It breaks our courage. It makes us feel like, why would I even try, right? Why would I even try? They're just going to stop me, right? I can't make it. This world's racist. I'm waiting for the white people to stop so that I can be successful, right? And that's evidenced by literature. So if you look at books written on the topic of race, particularly the Black experience, and racism against Black people. Primarily, these books are written by white authors. And what I think is worse than that, they're primarily written to a white audience. So this is a conversation that is primarily being had away from Black people, not involving Black people, about Black lives. And isn't that similar, right, to the last 200, 300 years of history, right, where we are just waiting around for white people to make decisions that are going to impact our lives. So Black resilience is about, no, we're in control. We're in control of a lot more than society and the mainstream and the common narrative wants to give credit. We have access to so many opportunities. And yeah, sometimes we do need to go get it in the dirt. And sometimes it isn't easy, but we're capable of achieving at levels that are so exceptional, it will blow the world wide open, right? And there are a plethora of different examples of excellence being personified by Black people and Black communities. And we need to just focus a little bit more attention on shining light on that, because that's what inspires the next generation to say, you know what? I've seen that. I just saw a Black doctor today. I could do that too. I saw a Black hedge fund manager. Maybe I could do that too. I saw a Black lawyer working on Wall Street. You know what? Maybe I'm going to add that to my list of things that I could maybe do, right? I'm not limited to just being successful in, you know, in sports or in music. I can succeed in any industry, right?
Exactly. Ms. Anderson, talk to us about you moving to the U.S. and attending college and playing basketball Division I and going to law school at the same time.
Yeah, so opportunity is funny, right? It doesn't always shine and sparkle and have flashing lights. Sometimes opportunity is dusty. It doesn't look quite right. You're not even sure what it is, mm-hmm. right? You've got to pull it out of the mud and clean it off before you can even. And that was kind of what my opportunity to initially go to the United States was. It was an opportunity to go to North Carolina right. to play at a school in the middle of nowhere, rural North Carolina, that really was mostly, it was a homeschool situation out of a two-bedroom apartment. And there are 16 boys in that apartment. So you got 16 boys from the ages of 13 to 19, right? We're playing basketball about 9, 10 hours a day. We're getting groceries dropped off about once a week, right? So you can imagine, I mean, we had guys sleeping all over the floors, all over the living room. We had somebody in a sleeping bag on the kitchen floor, right? And every time the groceries get dropped off, we'd fight over food.
Right.
And people would try to throw food in their room and hide food under their mattress. This was rough, right? And we had, you know, kids from difficult situations, all of us from difficult childhoods. And, you know, we were ready. Everybody was ready to fight for opportunity and fight for food and playing time and whatever they needed to. And that was a really interesting segue for me, having been homeless before going down to North Carolina. To me, it was obvious. It was an obvious choice that I was going to go do this. And even though it was tough, it was obvious that I was going to stick it out until I found a better opportunity, right? There were a lot of kids that went home, right? And understandably called their mom and said, hey, listen, I'm starving. I haven't eaten a proper meal in weeks. And I tried to get a piece of bread from the fridge and I got punched in the face. Right. Most parents, if you call them, they'll say, I think you should come on home. But for me, I knew I was out there on my own and I knew I didn't have anything home, you know, at home to come back to. Right. And so my goal became, all right, this isn't the best situation. This is all I got. And there are college scouts in this gym. Right. The basketball piece of it, we had Andrew Wiggins at that school who, as most viewers and listeners know, went on to become the number one overall pick in the draft. And, you know, we had a good basketball team and we competed in front of, you know, hundreds of Division I NCAA scouts. So my thinking was, if I can increase the awareness of my skill set and my profile as an athlete, I can get an opportunity to go to a better school next year, another boarding school with a real cafeteria, with a better education system, and I can really elevate my situation and my status. And that's what I did. So the next year, I had an opportunity to go to Wilbraham and Munson, which is a school outside of Boston near Springfield, Mass. And it's an incredible institution, top level education that I received there, and ended up leveraging that to get a scholarship to Kansas, which was the number one overall basketball program in the country
right
at that time. And you got to zoom out and pause there for a second and think about what just happened to this kid who was homeless, then had this ridiculous situation in North Carolina, scratching and clawing, and no one knew who he was. And now he just signed with Kansas. Right. I was on top of the world. I was living an absolute, just a dream, right? Story, just a story tale, you know? And from there, you always have to be ready for the drop on the roller coaster.
Right.
You know? So the NCAA did a review of my education and saw that year in North Carolina and unfortunately decided to make me a partial qualifier. And there's, of course, the underlying narrative of, what, that's not fair, you know, because I had a 1450 SAT. So, you know, on my end, I'm like, come on. I mean, I'm clearly a great student. I clearly know what I'm doing. You know, don't punish me because of this messed up situation, you know, for something that I had no control over, right? I didn't have control over whether the coach who took me to that school in North Carolina did the proper paperwork with the NCAA,
mm-hmm.
right? Not something that I could control. And it ended up robbing me of the opportunity to play at Kansas. But as often is the case in life, when you're presented with a setback, you have a choice. You have a variety of choices that you now need to make. Yes, the circumstance, the condition that has now presented itself, that has now caused you to have to make a decision, that may not be your fault. It may not have been within your control. You may not have been able to plan for it. It may not be fair. It may be almost impossible to overcome. But it's not impossible. And you do, in fact, have this choice now. You choose how you're going to respond. Response. That has been my bread and butter. I think it's what has enabled me to achieve what I've achieved. And I think it's ultimately what has saved my life. How are you going to respond when something like that happens? And in this case, I responded by, okay, where else can I go? Right? I was being pushed to go to JUCO, but I just felt like I had too much pride as a student to go to a JUCO. There's nothing wrong with going to JUCO in general, but I'm just giving you a window into my mentality. I was like, no, I don't need to go to a JUCO. I want to go to college. I want to go to university. I want to go get my degree right now. I want to go get a bachelor's. And so I end up going to Fresno State with the idea that I'm going to be a big fish in a small pond. Paul George just came out of there. Rodney Terry, who had just been at Texas, and now he's back at Texas, went over to Fresno as head coach. I knew who he was. Michael Schwartz, who was at University of Miami before, had just moved over to Fresno as well. Both of these guys had recruited me, right, before I signed with Kansas. And so I was like, you know what, let me take my talents over there. And that was going to be a good situation. I honestly think if everything happened according to plan, right, I probably would have got drafted. And who knows if we would be having this conversation right now. But the roller coaster never stops. A month before the season was set to start, I break my neck in a car accident. Right? We get hit by a drunk driver. Not my fault. Again, you can't control some of these things that happen to you. But, you know, from there, I had a 0.06% chance of making a full recovery. I had to learn how to walk again. Lost 70% of my body weight. Right? But was able to scratch and claw and fight and use that as an opportunity to graduate a little bit early because I had the medical red shirt. And that's what enabled me to be able to play while in law school. But, you know, I'll kind of pause there and unpack that a little bit.
This is In Black America. We'll be back with more of our conversation in a moment. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Kay Braden Anderson, attorney, entrepreneur, philanthropist, and author of Black Resilience, The Blueprint for Black Triumph in the Face of Racism. Mr. Anderson, talk to us about when you visit your uncle down in South Florida. That's more or less changed the direction of the man you became today.
Yeah. So my uncle was a gastrointestinal surgeon in South Florida, and we didn't have a ton of opportunity to connect, but him living in South Florida, me living in Western Canada, you almost couldn't be further away, right?
Right.
And, you know, but we hadn't caught up in a while, and he was like, hey, Braden, you know, come down to South Florida. Let me take you to a Miami Heat game, and let's catch up. You know, he had also heard that I was struggling a little bit. This was, you know, one of the periods where I was kind of in and out of homelessness, living at home, living on other people's couches, you know, kind of bouncing around. And I was having some issues in school, right? You know, I was obviously dealing with a lot at home, and I'm sure a lot of that frustration kind of bore itself out in school and in the classroom with teachers. But I also was dealing with a tremendous amount of racism and just unacceptable behavior from teachers, right? I had teachers tell, you know, if I was speaking out or I was, you know, not paying attention, I had teachers call the principal's office and say, can you get someone to take this N-word out of my classroom, right? Like, I was dealing with all sorts of nonsense, right? And that certainly was impacting my performance in the classroom. And so I had attitude about it, as a lot of kids do. I had attitude about it. If you tried to lecture me and tell me I needed to do better in school, I just was dealing with a lot. And so the thought that I could, that I was responsible, it's kind of what happens when you are a victim, right? When you've been victimized, it's just overwhelming to think that after all that this world, this life has put me through, I'm getting tied to a tree, I'm getting beat up by my stepdad, I'm being called the N-word every day by my teacher, and now you want me to work harder in school? Give me a break, right? I'm 12 years old, right? And that was hard for me. But I went down to Florida just honestly looking to have a good time and watch a Heat game. But we had a conversation. We were sitting in his Rossi in Q1. It's kind of like a Ferrari. It's a supercar. It's in video games, right? It's a cool car. And we're so just to paint the setting, right? I'm like just absolutely amazed by his life. I've never seen a car like this. I had never slept in a house as nice as his, right? I don't think I'd seen a house or a car as nice as the stuff that he had. And so we're having a conversation. I'm paying attention, you know, and he brings up the topic of school and how I'm doing in school and how I'm going to be more successful and in the classroom. And at first I started to tune him out because it's another lecture about school. But you know, after he was done, you know, it wasn't anything groundbreaking initially what he said. But after he was done, I asked him a question because I was intrigued a little bit based on his life and what he was able to accomplish. That's what was intriguing for me was, look at what you've done with school. This is, you got my attention, right? But the question was, Uncle Rob, could I do what you did? Could I become a gastrointestinal surgeon? And that question, I didn't ask that question because I wanted to become a gastrointestinal surgeon. I didn't really know what I wanted to do yet. Doctor or lawyer, maybe. I don't know. I just wanted to get paid and feel fulfilled and have a career that was rewarding, that I was good at. And his response is definitely something that changed my life. The confidence that he responded to me with, the genuineness in his voice and the way that he looked at me,
mm-hmm.
He told me, of course you could. right? He was almost offended by the question. He was emotional. You could tell that he firmly believed that I was capable of doing any and everything that he had done and accomplished. And I could feel it, right? It was like an out of body. It was like something clicked in my mind that made me so reverently believe in the genuineness of what he was saying from a position of knowledge, right? He had been through everything that it took to get to where he was at. So he knew how hard it was. I didn't even know. I wasn't in the position to properly evaluate whether I was or was not capable of doing it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was. And that caused me to at least promise him, right?
Right.
I'm going to work as hard as I possibly can, right? Because he essentially said, if you work as hard as you can, if you give 100%, because I know you're not giving 100%, and I know you're dealing with a lot of stuff, but if you give 100%, you can do anything. You can do anything you put your mind to. You can certainly become a gastrointestinal surgeon. I'll teach you everything I know, right? You can certainly do that if that's what you want to do. But let's start with you just giving 100%. And that next semester, I made a concerted effort to just forget about it. Teacher's going to call me the N-word. I'm going to get beat up tonight. I might sleep on a friend's couch. I might sleep on a park bench. I don't really give a crap. I'm going to give my all in school every day. I'm going to work as hard as I can. I don't care if I got to do the homework under a streetlight. I'm going to get it done. And let's see what happens. And that resulted in my grades, my GPA over doubling in one semester. And you know, I went from a DC student to a CB student, right? From a CB student to an AB student, right? And it just kept gradually improving.
K. Braden Anderson, attorney, entrepreneur, philanthropist, and author of Black Resilience, the Blueprint for Black Triumph in the Face of Racism. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at KUT.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio. From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
Well, back in 2017, I had a business partner out of Los Angeles there. We were putting this idea together of actually African-Americans owning their own television network. We looked out there in the play field there, pretty much knowing there was only BET, and there was at that point TV1. It's only two people in the game that actually were relevant. So I'm thinking in my mind, how could this be more expanded where we don't have the big box companies controlling what we see in our content and things of that nature. So fast forward to 2020, partner and I, we decided to sit down and see if we go after some streaming type of apps or OTT types of networks that are out there that will allow us to put our content out not through traditional cable, but through the streaming process. And at that time, it was at the curve, right at the beginning of where things are now today. Everybody's streaming.
Jerry Adam, president and CEO of VTV. Adam has joined forces with award-winning music pioneer Ben Tankard. Tankard is a platinum-selling Billboard chart-topping artist known as the godfather of gospel jazz, who is also an author, pilot, pastor, and NBA motivational speaker. Adams has extensive experience in media markets, promotion, and production. The collaboration is a joint venture between their new streaming networks, Smooth Life TV and VTV. The Tankard and Adams joint venture represent continual economic growth for the entertainment industry and investment by African-American-owned media suppliers. VTV is an American-based international streaming service targeting African-American audiences. Smooth Life TV Network is a streaming service that will showcase relaxing music, movies, and unique programming, targeting mindset and money matters. I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Smooth Life TV and VTV with Jerry Adams and Ben Tankard, In Black America.
We met through a good friend of many years, Broderick, who worked with the gospel music industry as a consultant, promoter, and, you know, and so we kind of connected through a longstanding gospel relationships. And Jerry and I, we just kind of met and connected, and he had already been doing the TV thing for some time. And I just launched my app and I said, you know, something, two are better than one. Let's do this thing together. I've got a bigger name, but I know nothing. And you know everything. And people don't know you. People, and not as many people know as you yet. So let's just merge us up. And 1 + 1 = 3.
Ben Tankard, legendary artist and music mogul. Tankard's resume includes 15 gold and 6 platinum-selling albums, multiple number one Billboard smooth jazz radio singles, 17 Stellar Awards, and a Stellar Music Hall of Fame induction. He's an author, a reality TV dad, pilot, NBA motivational speaker, and pastor. One would think with all this going on, where you would find the time for something else? Well, he has. Tankard is partnered with Jerry Adams, president and CEO of VTV. The collaboration will bring together two streaming services, VTV and Smooth Life TV. This partnership will bring new voices and reshape the landscape of ownership and representation by African Americans in media. The joint venture represents continued economic growth for the entertainment industry and investments by African American owned media suppliers. Recently in Black America, spoke with Jerry Adams and Ben Tankard.
The most important thing today is that I'm your fifth cousin twice removed through marriage in Jesus. But there are several ways that people could possibly know Ben Tankard. Some people remember me from my short NBA days back in the 80s as a shooting guard for the Portland Trailblazers. Might not have seen me because I was on the bench. That didn't last long. I got injured and cut and got into music. So many people may have heard me through my music as a producer with Yolanda Adams and my own music as a gospel jazz recording artist. And then most recently, people might have heard about me through my family reality TV show, Thicker Than Water, The Tankard, which started out on the Bravo Network and is now on the Smooth Life TV Network, which is what brought me to collaborate with my friend Jerry Adams and what we're talking about today, the TV world.
Mr. Adams, tell us a bit about yourself.
Well, I'm out of the city of Chicago originally, and I'm housed here in Atlanta now. I was the former general manager of Worldwide Gospel right there in Texas. We had artists like Keith Wonderboy, Evelyn Tarantine, A.G., and we've done work with Damon Little and various ones. I'm now the CEO and president of the VTV Television Network. However, I've done various different projects with the Stellar Awards in terms of management with events and post and pre-events, and also some of the planning. I do and sit on several boards around the country with certain entertainment entities. And I'm here in Atlanta, and I work with some of the wonderful wonderful people that are in entertainment right now, and that's people like the C Room and places like that, gospel and entertainment. So that's basically my rundowns, a lot of them, things that we've done.
So how did you guys get together?
We met through a good friend of many years, Broderick, who worked with the gospel music industry as a consultant promoter, and you know, and so we kind of connected through a longstanding gospel relationships, and Jerry and I, we just kind of met and connected, and he had already been doing the TV thing for some time, and I just launched my app, and I said, you know, something, two are better than one. Let's do this thing together. I've got a I've got a bigger name, but I know nothing. And you know everything, and people don't know you. People, and not as many people know as you yet. So let's just merge us up, and 1 + 1 = 3.
Come on, Jerry. How did you form VTV? How did that project come to fruition?
Well, back in 2017, I had a business partner out of Los Angeles there. We were putting this idea together of actually African-Americans owning their own television network. We looked out there out in the play field there, pretty much knowing there was only BET, and there was at that point TV One. It's only two people in the game that actually was relevant. So I'm thinking in my mind, how could this be more expanded, where we don't have the big box companies controlling what we see in our content and things of that nature. So fast forward to 2020, partner and I, we decided to sit down and see if we go after some streaming type of apps or OTT types of networks that are out there that will allow us to put our content out, not through traditional cable, but through the streaming process. And at that time, it was at the curve, right at the beginning of where things are now today. Everybody's streaming. But very few people was even thinking along that wise. So we were able to acquire a company that was able, some app developers out of Texas right there, that actually was able to give us the opportunity. We shelled out the money to get it done. But the actual structure of it was basically keeping it where it speaks to our community, not excluding other communities, but it speaks primarily to our community. And what we wanted to see, and talking to our, you know, talking to our base, and that is what was the driving force with me. Of course, you had to, you know, have to get people on board. You had to get tech people involved, marketing people involved, production. And we all know content is king. So I have to go after the right content providers. So that's how I landed here at VTV Network.
How does that process work? I'm talking about the streaming process. Okay, you have a product. And to get that product from point A to point B, and I guess point B is in someone's home. So talk to us through that process.
Oh, well, what happens is if you all, your listeners, probably all of them, probably 80% of them or 50%, I'll go as high as that, have a Roku television. We saw Roku over at Walmart. We saw Roku over at Best Buy. They have those Hisense televisions and things of that nature. But we were not in that arena, we're in that space. So how do we get a content provider content to a platform large like that? And by us developing what we developed, we were able to provide them. So how that works is that they're going to provide their content to VTV or Smooth TV, Smooth Life TV, I'm sorry. And we have people that would vet that product, and then we'll say if it fits our format or our agenda, if you will. And then we make that decision. And once that happens, within our individual networks, we have the capability of actually uploading that content into our system. And what that is that by being a streaming platform, that's where it's all going now. Streaming can get you into more homes and faster and at a cheaper rate. So that's merely the way that they make it happen. You get it first become attractive to the network itself. In our case, Smooth Life TV, it's entertainment based, it's instrumental, it's the festivals, it's all that great stuff. And then with my network, the VTV television network, we don't have so much of it, the live portion of it, but we do a lot of scripted content, short film, things of that nature, and talk shows. So if it appeals to either one of our networks, this is how we make the determination of as to how to put that content on our platforms. But the great thing about this is that streaming is so huge right now. We're over into Apple TV. We're over into Android television and phones. We're over into smart TVs now, the Hisense and Vita. It's just the list goes on and on. So they saw that now it is getting more of the profit share. It's getting more of more eyeballs on the fact that, for lack of a better word, on the streaming portion at a less cost versus the cable that we've seen out there with Xfinity, Comcast, and things like that, with charging an arm and a leg, and you're not getting as much for that. So now the trajectory of the whole game has changed. It's now the streaming portion where you're paying $50 a month. You get all these apps that you would never probably see in your whole life. You get them all there at your disposal. But we can do way more things with it for less than money. So I hope I'm answering your question, but I think this is the wave of the future. I think that this is where we're going. I think that we as African Americans as well, I don't know all the way your demo, your base, but I want to speak to that community. We can actually do it. We can take it from a conception to completion. It become an idea. It can actually get out there in people's homes and on their phones. So I think we have the bull by the horn, if you will, Smooth Life TV, as well as VTV Network. We have the doorway to that. And I think with us collaborating, my friend Ben and I, it's just going to open more and more doors, giving people more opportunities. It's going to spread the whole thing out much better across the world right now.
I understand. So, Ben, when did you and Jules decide that you want to be a mogul in television? Of course, you were smitten by Thicker Than Water, the Tankers. So mm-hmm. now you all wanted to go out on your own and be your own boss and produce your own content. So when did you all come up with that idea?
Well, that's a great question, man. This isn't my first rodeo of waking up and smelling the coffee, because mm-hmm. you know, you and I have talked about this over the years. You know, I was with Sony Verity Records for 16 years. And so everybody knows, well, not everybody knows, just a little short lesson in being a recording artist and getting royalties. Basically, you know, the record company signs you and, you know, they put up the money and they promote the record. And if you're lucky, they will pay you a dollar for every copy that you sell. So let's just say you have a great year in gospel, which is 100,000 sales. Well, that's $100,000 that they would give you. But what happened to the other nine? because when you go on Amazon and iTunes, which is basically how people buy these days, that $9, that $10, that entity, Amazon or iTunes, they take out their cut for distributing it, which is $3, and then they send that $7 to the record company. In my case, it was Sony. So Sony would give me a dollar, and they would keep $6. And so if I sold 100,000 copies, I get $100,000, but doggone it, they get $500,000, $600,000. Mm-hmm. So when
yes.
I found
oh,
that,
wow.
when I figured out that arithmetic, I said, wait a minute now, I can be the label.
Mm-hmm.
And so
yes.
when I left them after, you know, many years, 16 years, I opened up Benjamin, and I gave all that money to your cousin, Sister Tanker. we kept it in the family. So when we went to Bravo, and Bravo did our three seasons of Thicker Than Water, and we realized that we had 3 million fans following us on Sunday night, things began to turn when I found out that very few people are sitting down at the dinner table watching TV at the same time. When we got the ratings and stuff from Bravo, they would say most of your viewers is people that are going on their own schedule and pulling down the show and watching it video on demand or on their cell phone or on their iPad or in their offices on TV. And so when I found that out, I said, shoot, I'm going to do the same thing with TV that I did with music.
Right,
And that's how we opened up our own production company. And this last season of Thicker Than Water was not on Bravo. It was on Tubi, the Fox Network, which was the app that we was able to use to get the word out. Then I met Jerry, and I said, not only am I going to do this with Thicker Than Water, but I'm going to do this with anybody that can bring me content that we can have an agreement on, and let's open this up for other people that have an opportunity to get their music and their TV out, and their live concerts. And so I'm like, Jerry has the information. I got some of the know-how. Let's put our 2 cents together and make it and do like Byron Allen and Tyler Perry are doing, and joint effort. Yes. And let's make this name rock. So that's how I got into this mix.
Now, you talk about content. Obviously, if you're on 24 hours a day, you need a buttload of content. So where you are obtaining this content from?
Different sources. You know, I kind of threw a wide net out and said, the British is coming. We're opening the door. What you got? And so people began to send us clips of stuff that they're working on. We've already signed a lady over in Indiana that she's a pastor's wife, but she works out, and so she has a workout show that she's put together that's already in the can. And so at least from my side of the tracks, we're interested in people that have content that's already finished. All we have to do is put a label on it and play it. We're not into investing money in ideas. We're taking ideas that have already moved past the kitchen table into the studio, and we cut it up into 29-minute segments and air it right now. That's what I'm looking for. But Jerry can kind of
Jerry,
tell you
go
what
ahead.
He's going on his
How do end. You all obtain content for VTV?
Well, typically the same way that Brother Ben just mentioned. We want already packaged content, and we go after those types of content creators at movie festivals and things of that nature, you know, and at different outlets. People submit the content already created, preferably, definitely. There's only maybe one or two pieces on our network that we are investing in terms of our production team. But the majority of that is just like Mr. Ben said, you have to have this content come in already created, and it just does, like I said, stick a sticker on it and put it through the system. And
when you look at it, that's what, when you look at it, that's what the Netflix and Amazon Prime
licensing game. Yeah,
that's what they were doing. Only they were taking content from major studios. They were Warner Brothers,
and
they would take shows that have already been done that we watched on TV, and they were just replaying it on their networks. Mm-hmm. And then when they make enough money, they can say, "All right, here is a Hulu original." Or
and so
the smooth life originals ain't kicked in yet because we're still raising the money.
Absolutely, but that's the format. He just gave you the formula. That's basically it. That's what we're doing.
You're listening to In Black America with Johnny O. Hanson Jr. We'll be back with more of our conversation in just a moment. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio, and we're speaking with Ben Tankard, media mogul, also Jerry Adams, president and CEO of VTV. Gentlemen, why is it important for gentlemen such as yourself and ladies to do what you all are doing? Why is it important for us to tell our own stories, to be our own deliverer of information and entertainment?
Everyone has a voice, and history is his story. Everybody has a story, and who better to tell our stories than ourselves, than to have a perception through somebody else's lens, which might be the lens of bias, the lens of racism, the lens of jealousy. Who better to tell our own stories than ourselves and our people?
Jerry?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I concur with Ben. I think for me, in looking at how we as African Americans, I'm going to speak to that community right now, have been kind of noted as not being able to work together, or that type of thing, or some negative type of a cloud over our business operations. I wanted to dispel that. I wanted to show the world, in this case, that two African American owned companies and independently operated can work together in harmony, okay,
without the compromise of quality and content. So I think that is the substratum of where I think we were kind of coming from in our hearts. We want to display that thing, and that's why you saw us in that picture. Some of you guys have seen the press release with us holding hands or shaking hands. And we're saying the unity. We're unified. We're not fighting and we're not backbiting and we're not trying to outdo anything. Of course, it's a business. But at the same time, we can be all of that separately and we can be all of that together. That's the message I think that needs to be conveyed throughout our community.
What kind of financial commitment that you all had to make to each other to get this venture off the ground?
Well, we I'm going to be totally transparent. We still trying to figure it out.
Right. That part is
that I got two pieces of bread and Jerry got some bologna. We about to make a sandwich.
We got to make a sandwich. Come on, Doc. I like that. Yes. That's it. That's the concept.
And, you know, this thing started out as just a dream on the kitchen table. And it's developing, and it's growing legs. And I believe here's the preacher hat. Mm-hmm. I believe when Moses got backed up to the Red Sea, and the enemy was on one side about to catch them Pharaoh's army, and then you had this sea of questions, you had this sea of unbelief, not sure what was going to happen on the other side. They had no idea that God was going to part the Red Sea. But I believe this is the Benjamin translation. I believe that they actually had to get in the water and get their toes wet before God parted the Red Sea.
Now, Ben, I wanted to ask, how is this going to cut into your music making, or if at all?
Oh, actually, it's going to even enhance it because...
Talk to me.
Because every Sunday will be Jazz Sunday. Mm. So we've already put the word out to the Gerald Albrights, the Will Downings, the Take Sixes, and said, send us your concert footage, and we will play it on our network on Sunday. Mm-hmm. So people will start tuning in just to see their favorite jazz artist, and then they'll fall in love with some of the other content that we have on demand on the networks.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry, will that also translate to some of the gospel artists that you've managed or concerts that you have helped promote prior to your VTV?
Yes, it'll have the same effect. I think what ultimately happens is that we want to be seen. Everything visual is everything. Visual is king. And with us having our own platforms across the world, now I think it's 176 countries that I don't know how many continents it reaches, but it will enhance what we're doing here. I'm able to offer different things. I'm able to have some educational portions of things, just basically inspiring our people and educating our people about the industry that we're in, which happens to be entertainment. But yes, this will do just the same thing like Brother Ben was just saying. It will enhance it. It will give us more of an opportunity to reach more people. So I think that's
what I found out. When I left Sony, there was a little fear there, Brother Jerry and John. There was some fear because, you know, I'm used to hiding behind that name of Sony and using that as my resume. And so now I'm going out on my own. There was a little fear when I first stepped out. But then I found out from my fans that my fans, once you have a fan base, they don't care who I'm signed to. They will follow me wherever I want it to go.
Right.
So good content is good content. They don't care if it's on Warner Brothers, on Netflix. If it's good content, they will follow you. So I'm excited about this opportunity because I believe those names that we are able to capture, those people in the gospel and the jazz and actors and artists, if the content is good, their fan base will follow them, even if they have not heard about a BTV or a Smooth Life TV. Your fan base will follow you wherever you go. They don't care about the name of the label. They only care about the content.
Absolutely.
Because when something goes viral on YouTube, nobody checks the origin of it. When they watch it on TikTok or YouTube, all they get
right.
left, they're not, I'm not sure if I'm going to watch this. Where did that come from? Who are they signed to? So they only
no,
laughing
no, no.
at what they're looking at, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, the project is in its infancy. Where do you all see this effort 2 to 5 years from now? Jerry, you go first.
Well, I see this being a multi-million dollar collaboration. I just see that in my mind over the next 5 years. I think closer than that, I think in the next 2 years or so, I think you're going to see a significant impact on what streaming television can do. Okay, it can really change the trajectory of the actual playing field, because I think with us having the influence of television, which ain't going nowhere, people want to visually see something. And it also inspires, it trickles down to inspiring people to say, hey, if they did it, I can do it. If that type of movement that's going, I think it's going to go there in the next 5 years. We're looking at easily $100 to $200 million business. I mean, I can see it generate that kind of business.
I agree. And if we remember, this was a few years ago when people had to wait till they got home to check their voicemail.
Oh, come on.
They had to wait till they got home to put on the VCR. Mm-hmm. Not everything's mm-hmm. changed. You can be sitting up at the bus stop, pull your phone out, and watch your mm-hmm. favorite show. And
look
so
out.
Where before you had to, and I get home, my program's coming on, my story coming on. Now just pull out your phone, and you can be sitting on your iPhone, you sit on your app seat in your car. And so I believe because of that change, it opens up a whole opportunity for us to get involved on the early stage, you know, because if we would have been able to put in $100 into Amazon when we first heard about it, or the Walmart. So I feel like we're doing that with TV right now.
Yes.
And in 5 years, man, we're going to be buying major studios. I might have to retire you, John, man. I love the school, but y'all going to have to let John go. You come work with us.
Ben Tankard, legendary recording artist. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's americanarchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
I found hope in the midst of an overwhelming situation.
I let go of trying to control things that I had no control over, and that helped me find peace of mind.
Alcoholism is a disease that can affect any family. Everyone suffers, but there is help and hope at Al-Anon Family Groups.
I was constantly stressed and worried. Now I approach each day with joy and gratitude.
In Al-Anon, families and friends of alcoholics find new ways to heal from the effects of a loved one's drinking.
Al-Anon gave me my life back. I'm a better father and husband.
Are you in an overwhelming situation because of someone else's drinking?
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Local and virtual meetings are available. Maybe one could work for you. For information, call 1-866-200-0033 or visit alanon.org/hope.
If you're talking, they will hear you.
We all want our kids to grow up safe and healthy. So we show them how. And we tell them, with honest conversations that let them know what we expect. Not just one time, but every chance we get. That's especially important when it comes to alcohol and other drugs. Kids not only need to know the dangers and how to avoid them, they need to hear it often from you. And when it comes to pain medications, opioids, they need to know that they should never be taken without a prescription and never shared with friends or family. It's dangerous and illegal. So talk with your kids and guide them through the challenges of growing up safe and healthy. Because when you talk, they hear you. For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underage.